Thank you, David. Well, thank you all very much. I really, really appreciate that. First things first, because I want to support Maureen and her husband who are running the bookstore. On that back table over there by the exit, you'll see I brought some flyers advertising all of my books and my DVDs and my CDs. So please help yourself to them. And I think Maureen has copies of a number of my books. And tomorrow afternoon, I'll spend some time, I think maybe at 2:15 or so, we have a break. So tomorrow afternoon, I'll be in the bookstore autographing books if anybody would like, if anybody buys any of the books and would like me to autograph it, because it's always the joy of an author to kind of sign your name on your own book. Also, just to let you know, on that brochure, you're going to see my two best-selling DVDs. Now, Maureen does not have any of them, but I did bring some copies. And so if anybody's interested in buying either of my two DVDs, I'll be happy to sell them to you. They're very expensive, though. I need to, unfortunately, Paraclete Press, if you buy them from Paraclete Press, the publisher, they charge $89 for each one. They sell them to me for $47 a piece. I sell them for $50 because I don't want to deal with the cash. So anyway, it's $50 a piece if you're interested. So anyway, just see me and I'll be happy to strike a deal with you. Also, by the way, Maureen asked me, of course, this irritates me to no end, but those of you in Wilmington, you might listen to me on the relevant, my sister and I, you might listen to my sister and I on the relevant radio network because we have our own radio show on the weekends. And Maureen did tell me, much to my chagrin, Maureen did tell me that she's got copies of my sister's two books. So if you want to. All right, so come on, let's get started. So this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do this weekend. I'm going to talk tonight about the true self, the person that God created us to be. And then tomorrow morning, we're going to talk about the false self, the person that you and I make ourselves into. And particularly, we're going to talk tomorrow morning about the agenda of the false self that I think is the major distraction in the spiritual life. Then we're going to talk later. The third talk is going to be about how do we break free from the agenda of the false self. And then I've been specifically asked to talk about, and I've designed to talk about living in the present moment. Those of you who have read my book, Coming Home to Your True Self, Leaving the Emptiness of False Attractions, you will see in that book my little prayer technique about being present to the presence. But I'd like to offer you a larger presentation on a whole spirituality of why it's so critical to live in the present moment. The first things first, the person that God created us to be. You know, my friend, one of the great gifts that the Franciscan Order has given to me is I had the wonderful opportunity to go and to get a PhD, a doctorate, in the history of Christian spirituality. So I've had the rare privilege of reading all the great classics of our spiritual tradition. And I'll be referring to some of them periodically tonight and tomorrow. And as I survey the history of Christian spirituality, it's very, very interesting. Because I've discovered what I like to call the 10 characteristics of the true self. That as you and I become the person that God created us to be, you will come to see yourself growing in these 10 characteristics. So we're going to talk about those 10 characteristics tonight. And oftentimes when I give this presentation, I always like to remind people that as you listen to this presentation and as you hear the 10 characteristics, use it as an examination of conscience. Because you should be growing in each one of these characteristics if you're growing in your identity as a Christian, and more importantly, your identity as a Franciscan. So, the characteristics of the true self. Number one, and I'm going to start off with the most basic one of them all. And that is, the true self is relational. You must be involved in relationship. Christianity is a family affair. You know, my friends, when we were growing up, I suspect if you were like me, in the second grade, you were taught something very interesting. You were taught that the Bible says that we were made in the image and likeness of God. Think about that for a moment. Each one of us reflects something of God. Because you and me, we were made in the image and likeness of God. And so, if that's true, we must look to God to get a sense of who we are meant to be. And when you look to God, the first thing you discover, because it's one of the first principles of our faith, you come to discover that God is a Trinity. The Father is a Father because the Father has a Son. And the Son is a Son because the Son has a Father. And the Father and the Son are bound in a relationship with a super glue called the Holy Spirit. What makes God, God, is that at the very heart of divinity, there is a relationship. God is relational. And so, if I am made in the image and likeness of God, then I too must be in relationship. Now, the reason why I want to start with that one is simply because there's a cockamamie belief out there that the spiritual life is just about me and Jesus. And you're a threat. And so I got to keep you at a distance because you're a distraction to my spiritual life. Well, let me tell you something. With all due respect, we're not Buddhists. You know, Buddhism, you must run away from the world. But in Christianity, authentic Christian spirituality always drives you into the world to transform the world. Authentic Christian spirituality drives you to involvement, to engagement. There's no such thing in Christianity as a me and Jesus spirituality. It's all about us. Remember the great story? Remember the great story in the Sacrum Commercium? Where Lady Poverty says to Francis, I'm a little bit curious, Brother Francis. Where is your cloister? And remember, he takes Lady Poverty by the hand and he walks up to the mountain and he puts his hands out. And as he surveys all the valley, he proudly says, Lady Poverty, this is my cloister, the world. You must be driven into relationship if you're going to be a Christian. And of course, listen, let me tell you something. This is why, and please never forget it, hospitality is a path to holiness. Please remember that. Hospitality that we Franciscans are so proud of. Please, that is a path. You can become a saint simply by practicing on a daily basis hospitality. It's a virtue. It's a path to heaven. Please remember, every time you cook a meal and you invite someone to your table, every time you invite someone to have a beer with you in a bar, please remember That is a path to holiness. But let me tell you something. This is a Baptist center. I doubt there'll be any. I don't think there'll be any alcohol here. But if there is, please remember, you can always practice hospitality on me. But please remember, so the true self is relational. There's no such thing as a me and Jesus spirituality. And if you have a me and Jesus spirituality, I would like to challenge you to get out of that. Because we live in the world, and we are driven to the world, to be involved with the world, to be engaged with the world. That's what Christian spirituality does. The second characteristic of the true self, it's this. The true self is unflappable and unthreatened. Unflappable and unthreatened. Think for a moment. Think of how much time and energy you and I waste defending ourselves, making ourselves look good, always justifying why we're doing what we're doing. We spend tons of energy doing that. Always polishing our ego in front of each other. Always justifying ourselves. Always rationalizing what we do. Let me tell you something. People rooted in the true self, saints, you know what? They could care less what you think about them. They don't have time. They don't have time to get your approval or your acceptance. They simply do what God calls them to do. And that validates itself. When you're doing the will of God, when you do what God is calling you to do, you really couldn't care less what other people think, because doing God's will is validation all its own. You know who taught me that? Sister Lucinda. I wonder now where she is in the world. As you probably saw on my bio, 11 and a half years of my life, I got to live my childhood dream. I was a missionary in mainland China. And one of the great gifts that my missionary life in China gave me was I was the spiritual director for all of Mother Teresa's nuns in Asia. So I was responsible for them in South Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Malaysia, and Singapore. And so usually about four times a year, they would fly me out of mainland China, and I would go to either Japan or South Korea, Hong Kong, to give them retreats, that kind of thing. The sisters in Hong Kong run a home for elderly Chinese people who have no one to bury them. I don't know if you know it or not, but in Chinese culture, it is considered a great disgrace if you die and no one buries you. And so the Chinese will spend exorbitant amounts of money burying people. The amount of money that you and I waste here in America on weddings, the Chinese use for funerals. I always say to people, listen, you want to get married? Come to America. But you want to die? You want to die in China. Because they will send you out like a king or a queen. Anyway, so Mother Teresa's nuns in Hong Kong take care of elderly Chinese with no family. And then when they die, they give them a really nice funeral. So, one day, I'm with the sisters in Hong Kong, and Sister Lucinda, who was the local superior of the Hong Kong community, Sister Lucinda and I were together bathing one of the elderly residents. And as we were bathing the resident, Sister Lucinda looked at me and she said, "Oh, by the way, Albert, could you do me a favor today?" And I looked at her and I said, "Yeah, Lucinda, what?" She said, "Well, could you be on your best behavior today?" And I looked at her and I said, "Well, absolutely. Why?" She said, "Because there's a wealthy benefactor coming today. And we're hoping that she will give us $25,000 so we can renovate this place for the residents. So please, could you just be on your best behavior?" So I said, "Absolutely." Well, 15 minutes later, here she comes. She walks in. Well, no, actually, she didn't walk in. She made an entrance. She was dressed in the traditional Chinese dress called a qi pao. A qi pao is that long, slender dress that has a slit up the side. So she's got a qi pao on in bright red. And there's an arrogance about her. I mean, the moment she walked, you know, she's one of the, I'm going to have to go to Father Linus for confession. You know, she was one of these people, you know the type, as soon as you meet them, you just don't like them. She's got this arrogance about her, and she's got this cigarette dangling out of the right side of her mouth. And she's one of these people who has mastered the art of the cigarettes dangling out of the right side of her mouth, and she can talk out of the left side of her mouth. So she's looking around the place, and then she's got the gall to say, "Huh? Jiga di fang, jen mei isa. Ni men long face, your jen. Wei shema, ni wei lao den fu bu. Swan la, swan la." What she's saying is, "This place is a dump. And look at you. You're wasting your time. Why on earth are you taking care of old people? Forget it, swan la, forget it, forget it." Now listen. I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana. And my mama and my daddy, they taught me manners. And you know as well as I, you never go into anybody else's house and start calling it a dump. So she's going on like the wealthy big shot she thinks she is. And I am getting angrier and angrier. And I am taking that sponge and I'm hitting the back of this poor elderly man. I'm scraping his back. My underwear is getting tied up in a knot. And finally, I said, "You know what? Somebody's got to say something to this woman." So I turn and I'm just getting ready to give her a piece of my mind when Sister Lucinda looked at me with the eyes of a third grade teacher. Okay, you know those eyes. All right, you know those eyes. So I just zipped my lip. And it was very interesting. Lucinda said, "Xiao jie, ma'am, ni shuo de dui, what you say is correct. Jiga di fang, jian mei sa. Yeah, this place might be kind of a dump. Woman ka nung long face, or jian. Maybe we do waste our time. Then sure, but woman ganda, we do it. In way, because Yezu shua, just you ega ingai de sure. Because Jesus says, this is what he wants us to do. So ye, woman ganda. So we do it." And I thought it was very interesting. There was no rancor. There was no anger. Her blood pressure was normal. Mine had shot up. Her underwear wasn't tied up in a knot. Mine was. But totally unflappable, unthreatened. We do it because this is what Jesus asks of us. When you're doing the will of God, it justifies itself. And that's why, you know, it's an American obsession, this obsession we have to always seek the approval of others. Who cares? Who cares? As my Aunt Maggie used to always say, pardon my French, but I'm going to use the language she said it in. My Aunt Maggie used to say, it's none of your damn business what people are saying behind your back. It's true. It's true. Unflappable, unthreatened. Do what God calls you to do and never apologize for it. If people ask for an explanation and they want to know why, be willing to share. But never, never apologize for the will of God in your life. Never. The third characteristic of the true self. Now this one comes right out of the gospel of Jesus. So I had to make sure that it got within the top five. And it is this. People rooted in the true self are people of self-giving love. Notice the adjective. Self-giving love. It is a love that doesn't spend time looking in the mirror to see what it gets out of it. It's a love that doesn't look in the mirror looking to get the pat on the back. It is like Jesus' love, just a complete self-emptying, self-giving love. Please remember, people don't like to hear this, but let me give it to you straight. Obeying the laws and obeying the commandments will only get you to the pearly gates, but that's it. If you want to open up the pearly gates, as Bonaventure says, there is only one key to heaven. The love of the crucified. The key that opens up heaven is the cross. Self-giving love. She would die at the age of 24 years old. She spent more than half her life behind the walls of a cloistered Carmelite monastery in France. She never wrote a line of theology, not one line. And yet, in 1999, Pope John Paul II would confer upon her the highest honor in the Catholic Church. At that time, she would only be the third woman to receive this honor, and she would be the 33rd. Now there are four women. But John Paul II made Thérèse of Lisieux a doctor of the church. Now, I don't know if you know anything about how doctors are made in the church, but the tradition has always been you write volumes on theology. Then after you die, experts will pore over everything that you wrote. And then, if they have discovered no mistakes, they will then petition the Pope and ask him to confer the doctorate upon you. And the Pope, like a president of a university, has the final say. Thérèse never wrote a line of theology. And she gets the highest honor in the church. Listen, Francis of Assisi had the stigmata, and he's not a doctor of the church. I mean, how much money and who were the Carmelites paying off, for goodness sakes? But John Paul II says in the homily, as he confers the doctorate on Thérèse, John Paul II said, "I'm giving Thérèse of the Holy Face the doctorate for one reason and one reason alone. Because of the six words she said a week and a half before she died." Now listen, I make my money giving talks. Take good notes. Because after I die, I want somebody to take my notes, send them to the Pope. I mean, certainly I have said something that's worthwhile enough for me to get a doctor, to become a doctor at a church, for goodness sakes. But I don't know if you know the story of this great Carmelite mystic. So let me just briefly walk you through it again, because it's a fascinating story. And more tragically, we have caused Thérèse to become a plastic saint. It rankles me every time I go into a church and you see a statue of her with that goofy little smile holding the roses. Let me tell you the real story of this incredible woman. 2 years. Well, first of all her life as a Carmelite nun, she bore a deep guilt. And it was the guilt of her vocation. Because people in Lisieux, France said the reason why her father ended up in a mental asylum, as they called them in those days, the reason why Thérèse's father ended up in a mental asylum is because her and all her sisters had run to the convent. And their vocation and abandoning their father made him go crazy. And she bore this guilt for the 24 years of her life. Then, 2 years before she died, she starts spitting up blood. Tuberculosis. And the prioress of the monastery, the abbess, the boss, the prioress would not allow her the pain medication that was used at that time for people with tuberculosis, because the prioress said it was against poverty. So not only is Thérèse going through this emotional suffering of causing her father's mental illness, but she's also going through this physical pain of dying of TB. And if that is not enough, she is going through a profound darkness of faith. She's experiencing the dark night of the soul. So much so, she's fearing that she is losing her vocation. So, one day, she's so afraid she's losing her faith. One day, as she's spitting up blood, she takes a quill pen, and in her own blood, she begins writing out the Apostles' Creed. "I believe in God, the Father Almighty." She's trying to convince herself that she's not losing her faith. She would write the entire creed in her own blood. She would fold it up. She would have it sewn in her habit. And this precious relic would be found as the sisters prepared her body for the funeral. The nuns at the Carmel, the monastery, the nuns knew early on that Thérèse Martin, there was something special about her. And they really began to sense that they might have a potential saint on their hands. So they became obsessed with writing down everything that she said. A week and a half before she dies, she's in the infirmary. And her blood sister, Celine, who's also a nun at this monastery, this Carmel, her blood sister, Celine, comes into the infirmary to visit Thérèse. And Celine says to Thérèse, "Thérèse, tell me, what is the secret to holiness?" Thérèse opens up her eyes, looks with love at Celine, and she says, "Celine, the secret to holiness?" At which point, all the nuns with pen and paper come out of the woodwork like roaches on a hot July afternoon in New Orleans. They all come out with their notebooks. Thérèse says to Celine, "The secret to holiness?" And then she says her famous six words. "It is love alone that counts. It is love alone that counts." JP2, in the Mass, when he made Thérèse a doctor of the church, only the third woman at that time, number 33, he said, in those six words, Thérèse of Lisieux captured the essence of the gospel. And I would like to say, the essence of the spiritual life. Love and love alone. Let me tell you something. The spiritual life is not about having ecstasies. It's not about having visions. Those are all circus sideshows. That's paying money to go to the circus to see the woman with all the tattoos. Visions and all of that stuff, that's all nonsense. Those are circus sideshows. The essence of the spiritual life is love. Is love and love alone. It is love alone that counts. The fourth characteristic of the true self, and I give a whole half an hour presentation on my first DVD, is this: forgiveness. People rooted in the true self don't have Velcro personalities where everything sticks. Every day they spray themselves with Pam so nothing sticks. Did you know that of all the teachings of Jesus, it was his teaching on forgiving a neighbor that caused a revolution in the teachings of traditional Judaism? Because traditional Judaism, as it's inscribed in chapter 32 of the book of Exodus, Exodus says it perfectly. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, a foot for a foot. In Judaism, justice is done by getting revenge, but always in an equitable way. If you watched tonight's news or yesterday's news, you see it being played out right now. And it's really an embarrassment, is it not? Our American legal system is based on the Jewish understanding of justice. So you sue, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And Jesus says, you got it all wrong. Jesus says in his revolution, he says, you are to share with others what you yourself have experienced. Forgiveness. As the Father has forgiven you, so now you are called to forgive other people. I could go on and on about forgiveness, but let me just tell you something. Let me give it to you straight. Never forget. Forgiveness sets a prisoner free. And that prisoner is you. It's the best thing you can do for yourself. You know, your betrayer has gone on with their life. They're doing just fine. And there you are, still stoking the fires of resentment, stoking the fires of forgiveness, hanging on to that grudge. Doggone it, I'm going to take that grudge with me when I die. A lot of people do. A lot of people do. When you forgive, you set yourself free. And that's why it's so important to do to others what God has done for you. I'm just going to make allusion to point number 5, and then I'm not going to spend time with it because I'm going to give you a whole talk on this, the last talk that I give. But people rooted in the true self, saints, live in the present moment. They live in the present moment. This is where the action is. The action is nowhere else but right here. And that's where saints are content to live. Not in the past with guilt, and not in the future with worry and anxiety. They just live in the present moment. I'll talk more about this in my last talk. I'd like to give you the next two characteristics together because I learned them from an incredible, incredible teenager. People rooted in the true self are people of compassion, and they surrender to whatever life gives them. Compassion and surrender. It was a cold January afternoon. Third week of January, 1985, in the Chicago suburb of Naperville, Illinois. I had begun my doctoral studies at Fordham University, and I was asked by this parish, St. Margaret Mary's in Naperville, I was asked to come to Naperville and to preach them a parish mission. Actually, it was my very first parish mission ever. And now I do them all the time, but this is my very first one. When I arrived in Naperville, the pastor, Father Ted Weitzel, told me that there was a woman in his parish, a woman by the name of Margot, who was 16 years old and was dying. And he asked if I would go and visit Margot just to make sure she was prepared for death. Well, I'm embarrassed to admit it, but I didn't want to go. I mean, I'm 2 years ordained. I've got my whole future ahead of me. I have never been trained to deal with the dying. But you know, sometimes in ministry, you just do what you're asked and you keep your fingers crossed that you don't mess up. So I called the family and I said to them I would be coming. I got in my car, got to Margot's house, rang the doorbell. Her mother and her father welcomed me at the door and they ushered me into the living room. And there she was, Margot, in a hospital bed that she would spend her last days in. Margot and I chit-chatted for a while, and the whole time we were chit-chatting, I was trying to find a way to bring up the topic of death. And I was a little bit surprised. She was the one who broached the topic. She looked at me and she said, "I guess they told you, Father, I'm dying. And I nodded my head and I said, yeah, Margot, I know. Well, it must be pretty soon, Father, because I'm finding it harder and harder to breathe. She told me how she was dying of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, a disease in which you gradually lose control of your muscles. And the doctor had told her that one day the disease would reach her chest and her lungs would collapse and she would suffocate. So I guess it's going to be pretty soon, Father, because I'm finding it harder and harder to breathe. She would be right. She would be dead 10 days later. And I would fly back from New York, and I had the privilege of telling this story and preaching her funeral mass. So I looked at her and I said, Margot, do you find it hard to die? She looked at me and she nodded her head and she said, yeah, and no. So I said, well, what's hard about it, Margot? And she said, it's not fair, Father. Parents are not supposed to bury their children. It's the role of a child to bury their parents. And when I die, it's going to leave a tremendous hole in my mother and my father's heart. And I look at my classmates in high school. Most of them have never experienced death before. And now it's going to be my death. That's going to be their first experience. I just feel so sorry for them. It's just not fair. Let me tell you something. If there was anybody on planet Earth who had a right to be angry with God, it was little Margot. But the very moment she chose not to focus on herself and not to be filled with self-pity, and the minute she chose to focus her energies on the people who she was going to be leaving behind and their pain, let me tell you something. At that very moment, Lou Gehrig's disease lost its power to destroy her, and it became her path to holiness. Compassion, cum passio, literally means to suffer with. Please remember, friends, compassion, like hospitality, is a path to holiness. And never forget, compassion will never break your heart. All compassion does is stretch the size of your heart. And that's why people who are compassionate are people of extraordinary sensitivity. But remember, Margot also said it was not hard to die. So I asked her about that. I said, well, what's easy about it, Margot? She said, you know, Father, 3 years ago, I could do exactly what you're doing now. I could stand on my own 2 feet and I could walk freely. And then the disease started in my ankles. And there came the day I had to start using crutches. And then as the disease progressed, I had to let go of the crutches. And I had to use a walker. And then the day came I had to let go of the walker, and I was stuck in a wheelchair. And then the day came I had to let go of the wheelchair. And now here I am in this hospital bed. You know, Father, I've had to let go of my dignity. I can't even go to the bathroom by myself. I need somebody to wipe me. I can't even feed myself. I've had to let go of that. She said, you know, Father, every day for the past 3 years, it's been a task of letting go, letting go, letting go. And then she cast before me her most precious pearl. She said, and so, Father, when Sister Death comes knocking on my door, it's going to be another moment of letting go. And I've got that down pretty well. Surrender. Letting go. The mystical tradition considers it to be the highest spiritual practice to accept whatever God gives me. Let me tell you something. Did you know that all of your frustration, all the frustration in your life, it's not caused by your wife or your husband. It ain't caused by your teenage, well, maybe by your teenager. Maybe. It's not caused by your in-laws. You want to know where all the frustration in your life comes from? Look in the mirror. It all comes from your dogged need to be in control. Your dogged need to control and manipulate your life, my life, everybody else's life. And some of us even have the gall to try to control God. And let me tell you something. When you go through life with that kind of attitude where it's got to be my way or the highway, you're going to be filled with frustration. Because you know why? Life and God don't always agree with you. Let go. Surrender. Accept. Friends, this is what faith is all about. Faith is not about knowing the catechism from cover to cover. Faith is not about what's up here between your ears. Faith is the way you live. Faith is the way you walk. Faith is the way you live your life of trust in God. And that's what it's all about. And so we surrender. We let go. And we trust. Surrender and acceptance. Got 5 minutes. I got time. The next characteristic. I'm going to use the fancy word for the next characteristic. And then after I use the fancy word, I'm going to tell you my definition of it. Because unfortunately, a lot of people have a cockamamie idea of what it is. The true self is contemplative. And what I mean by that is simply this. Having eyes for God. That's what being a contemplative is. Always having your eyes open, waiting and watching for God. A couple of years ago, I gave a parish mission in Lakewood, New Jersey. Who knows Lakewood? Well, now, everybody in Lakewood are Jewish. What are you doing here? You can't be a Franciscan and be Jewish as well. Anyway, I don't know if you know it or not, but Lakewood, New Jersey is famous for one thing and one thing alone. It has the largest population of Hasidic Jews outside the state of Israel. The Hasidic Jews are the real conservative Jews. They wear the black trench coats. They have the hat. They have the earlocks. You see them in airports sometimes, the Hasidic Jews. Well, while I was in Lakewood preaching his parish mission, I found out the Hasidic Jews have a wonderful belief. They believe that every day of your life, God sends 100 angels into your life. Every day, you and I get 100 visitations from God. Now, if you believe that, what happened to the Blessed Mother at the Annunciation when Gabriel entered her life? Lady, that ain't nothing. I get 100 of those a day. But the difference between Mary of Nazareth and Albert Haas, Mary's eyes were open. She was wide awake. She was like a Zen master. And the moment the angel came into her life, she recognized Gabriel as a messenger from God. That's being a contemplative. Always having your eyes and your heart open, knowing that at any moment, God can come into your life. I'm sometimes asked to preach in Protestant churches. And I'll never forget, about 2 years ago, I was preaching in a Methodist church, and I found out that the song by Lanny Wolf that I used to always think was a Catholic song ain't. It actually comes from the Methodist hymnal. But it's a wonderful song. The refrain, sometimes I just repeat it to myself when I'm walking outside. But the refrain goes like this. Surely the presence of the Lord is in this place. I can feel his mighty power and his grace. I can hear the brush of angel wings. I see glory on each face. Surely, the presence of the Lord is in this place. That's being a contemplative. Bent over, putting clothes in the dryer, sitting in another one of those endless meetings, fraternity meetings, taking a shower, taking a walk outside, being in a church, no matter where you are, surely the presence of the Lord is in this place. I can feel his mighty power and his grace. I can hear the brush of angel wings. I see glory on each face. Surely, the presence of the Lord is in this place. I was a young deacon in St. Jude's Parish in New Lenox, Illinois. You have got to be kidding. Well, thank God I'm not going to say anything bad about New Lenox. Anyway, I was a newly ordained deacon. I had been in the parish for 4 months. And one day, Sister Marcia, the pastoral associate, came up to me. And she said, "So, Brother Albert, ain't it fun? Full-time ministry. Isn't it terrific?" I looked at her like she was from planet Pluto. And I said to her, "Fun? Terrific?" I said, "Marcia, I think I've made a mistake." And she said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, every time I sit down to work on a sermon, the doorbell rings. Every time I sit down to work on an adult education talk, the phone rings. Every time I sit down to prepare for the RCIA class, somebody shows up at my door." She says, I said, I'm trying to get my work done and I'm always being disturbed. She gave me some great advice. She looked at me and she said, Albert, remember, God never makes an appointment. Boy, is that true. You know, friends, we have a God who's got a very bad habit. He shows up at the most inconvenient of times in the guise of the most unacceptable people. As I always like to say on my radio show, he's a God of surprise and disguise. And you got to keep your eyes open because he's going to come into your life every day, 100 times a day. And so, like the Blessed Mother, keep your eyes open. Characteristic number 9. And some of you are not going to like to hear this one. People rooted in the true self have a passion for peace and justice. But let me tell you something. Shame on us Roman Catholics. Because whenever anybody gets in the pulpit and preaches about peace and justice, our first reaction is, how dare that priest say that? He's got to be a Democrat. I bet you he voted for Obama. Shame on us. Let me tell you something. Passion for peace and justice is not optional. It is not optional. And that's why I love to tell people, when you get your credit card bill every month, rather than simply pay it, why don't you think about praying over it? And maybe your eyes will be open. How can you possibly, in a world of ours, how can you possibly justify dinner for two for $125? How can you justify that when there are people going around starving in the world? How can you possibly justify allowing the water to constantly run when you're brushing your teeth? Help me to understand that. How can you justify that? How dare any of us? It rankles me when I'm hearing people talk about those children and their mothers crossing the border into Texas, and they should all be sent back. Excuse me. This country was founded on immigrants. You wouldn't be here if we did that to your aunt. You cannot. I mean, there comes a point, my brothers and sisters, we have to begin to stand up for peace and justice issues. And as Franciscans, all the more we should be in the forefront of this. Why on earth does it take a Jesuit pope to waken us up to our vocation? I mean, do you see the irony of that? A Jesuit pope. Somebody paid a lot of money for that. But no, seriously, pray over your credit card bill, because it will reveal everything. It will reveal a lot about you, about your lifestyle, and whether or not you're on fire with peace and justice. You know, it's very interesting in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 4. Luke goes into a synagogue in Capernaum, and it's on the Sabbath, and they ask him to do the reading. And so they hand him the scroll of the prophet Isaiah. And it's very interesting because Luke adds a very interesting detail. Luke says Jesus specifically looked for the passage where it was written. It was his mission statement. And he read it and he said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the poor, to bring freedom to captives, to give sight to the blind, and to let the oppressed go free, and to announce a year acceptable to the Lord." And then he rolled it up. He handed the scroll back to the attendant. And then, I mean, he must have had gall. He looked at the people in the synagogue and he said, "Guess what, baby dolls? That passage is fulfilled in me. Now, you and I, on the day of our baptism, we became a Christian." The word Christian literally means a little Christ. I write about this in my latest book, Catching Fire, Becoming Flame. A little Christ. And so the mission statement of Jesus is now my mission statement. And it's your mission statement. The Spirit of the Lord is upon us because the Lord has anointed us. The Lord has sent us to bring good news to the poor, to give sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, and to announce a year favorable to the Lord. That's our mission. Peace and justice. It's not an option, and it's not some liberal democratic agenda. It is the very heart of the gospel of Jesus Christ, setting captives free. And we got to get serious about it. And I still say, we Franciscans should be in the forefront of this. We should be getting in buses, going down to Texas, and helping those people. I mean, how can we possibly just sit back and let it just go? Shame on us. You know, I'm thinking, I just came back last night. Last night, I just flew back. I got home last night at 10 o'clock at night in Dallas-Fort Worth. I was preaching in Oklahoma City. This is all the music they play in Oklahoma City. Finally, the last, and I didn't mean to keep y'all this long. I am so sorry. The last characteristic number 10 of 10 of the true self. And that is, people rooted in the true self are people of gratitude. Gratitude. It's been said that gratitude is the best get-rich-quick scheme there is. You don't have to buy a lottery ticket to get rich. You just have to become aware of what you already have. It's the best get-rich-quick scheme there is. It's been said that God can be found in two places, in heaven and in a grateful heart. Gratitude. Living with the awareness. Have you ever noticed people who are grateful? Have you noticed how they vibrate at a different level than you and me? Have you noticed that? Have you noticed how people who live lives of gratitude, they don't have worry and anxiety because they know worry and anxiety are insults to God. Every time you worry, every time you're anxious, you are in effect saying, "God cannot be trusted, so I got to put my finger in this and I got to get my business in this." That's what worry and anxiety is. You can't trust God, so you've got to take charge. Not people who are grateful. People who live lives of gratitude live with the awareness that everything is a gift, a grace, and a blessing. Everything. My spouse, my car, my house, my children, my grandchildren, my education, the clothes I'm wearing right now, the very fact that I am breathing right now, everything is a grace, a gift, and a blessing. Let me tell you something. when you go before God, you can never say, this is mine. Except for your sin, everything else, including this watch, is a gift, a grace, and a blessing. Let me just conclude with this, because it's something very interesting for us Franciscans. You know, for most saints, we really don't know what their image of God was, how they thought about God. You know, as soon as I say the word God, everybody in this room, there are about 300 people in this room, and there are 300 images of God. We all have a different image of God. But isn't it interesting? Because from the sources and from his writings, we know exactly what Francis's image of God was. We know how Francis thought about God. Because for Francis, God was the divine almsgiver. He gave everything. And that's why no less than 4 times in his testament, he uses the words, the Lord gave me. The Lord gave me this. The Lord gave me that. The Lord gave me this. God was the divine almsgiver. And that is why Franciscan poverty and Franciscan simplicity of life, it is not like Benedictine poverty. You know, Benedictine poverty is a poverty where you deny yourself so you can focus all of your energies on God. That's the monastic understanding of poverty. You deny. But Franciscan poverty and Franciscan simplicity of life, they are radical affirmation, because they affirm that God can be trusted. That's Franciscan poverty in a nutshell. That's why we live a simple life. To proclaim and to affirm that God is the divine almsgiver. And he has sworn by the blood of Jesus Christ that he will give us everything that we need. We don't always get what we want, but by damn, we do get everything we need. And that's why some people live and vibrate on a different level called the level of gratitude. The great 14th century mystic Meister Eckhart said it best. Eckhart said, if the only prayer you ever pray is thank you, Lord, that's enough. If the only prayer you ever pray is thank you, Lord, that's enough. Because in that prayer, you recognize that everything is grace, gift, and blessing. May the Lord give you his peace.
So you think we should have him back for tomorrow's talks? Brothers and sisters, just a quick announcement. We will.